Lecture 4, Defamation.
Greetings. This time we're going to be talking about defamation. Defamation is a tort that many of you are familiar with, to a degree at least, often called libel or slander. Well, libel and slander are subsets of defamation. Libel is where you defame someone, lie about someone, and injure their reputation in writing. Slander is where you do the same thing, but you do it in words, orally, verbally. Now, the key to defamation is saying something false that harms someone else's reputation. The trick is harm to reputation. So the question is, can you really slander a member of Congress? Can you libel a lawyer? Or is their reputation not already so bad that nothing could further harm it? Well, in theory, yes, you can. You can even slander or libel a congressperson or a lawyer. The key to defamation, the first part of defamation, is a defamatory communication. A defamatory communication. And this communication must be a communication of fact. You must say something of fact that is defamatory and harmful to reputation. Well, again, this is a recurring problem in the law. How do you define a fact? What's the difference between a fact and an opinion? You can't, it's not defamatory if you simply express an opinion about someone. But if you express a false fact, it is defamatory. Now, fact and opinion can blur together. And you can't protect yourself just by saying, in my opinion. If I were to say, in my opinion, President Clinton is a bad president, would that be defamatory? No, it's a criticism, but it's not defamatory because it's an opinion. It's obviously very subjective. What if I say, in my opinion, President Clinton is into sheep? Well, I said, in my opinion, but that's still a factual type allegation, and that could be defamatory. One of the keys here is the precision of the statement. Is it a general statement, like someone's a bad statement, or is it something very precise? Is it something very precise? The more precision, the more likely it is held to be found a fact, and therefore a potentially defamatory communication. But of course, not all facts are defamatory. It has to be something that injures the reputation, and there's all sorts of precedents here with the sort of fact that's so defamatory, it injures a reputation. And some things are not defamatory. For example, there's a general rule, you can't defame the dead. You can't defame the dead, which is why, of course, there are all these books about Kennedy and all these other people. After they're dead, you can say anything about them you want, and it's not defamation. Can't hurt the reputation of the dead. Well, of course you can, but I suppose there's no real damages. Statements that are constitute an injury to reputation include many things that just are considered bad. If I see someone is a crook or is a thief, that's a defamatory communication. I'm accusing them of a crime. There are some kind of interesting cases here. For example, it's long-standing rule in the courts for centuries that it is defamatory to call a woman unchaste or impure. That's defamatory. But the law said it's not defamatory to call a man unchaste. Just a little bit of residual sexism there. There have been some interesting cases. One case said it was defamatory to announce that a guy had wife trouble. Well, I think that's pretty vague and almost opinion-like, but that was held to be defamatory. As a general rule, saying someone is bankrupt is not defamatory. But it may become so in circumstances, that is, if you're competing for business with someone and you say they're bankrupt, that might be defamatory. And this is an important thing to understand. That is, what is defamatory can vary by the circumstances. What if I say that person sells bacon? Well, that doesn't seem so defamatory, does it? Selling bacon? Well, if that person claims to be kosher, it certainly is defamatory. Likewise, what if I say, oh, they just had twins? Well, that's not defamatory, unless I also add that they were married 3 months ago, perhaps. And of course, communications depend a lot, the nature of these communications depend a great deal on just society and society's perception. Because after all, what is reputation but perception? Consider the concept of calling someone gay. Well, if you called someone gay last century, it would not have been defamatory at all. The word gay meant high-spirited, fun-loving, that sort of thing. Then gay became used as a term for homosexuality. And because being called a homosexual could hurt your reputation, in certain parts of society at least, calling someone gay might be considered defamatory, under some circumstances at least. So gay went from being non-defamatory to defamatory. Now, if homosexuality becomes more accepted in our society, calling someone gay would not be defamatory. There are certainly circles of people in some of America's large cities where there is no opprobrium attached to being gay. And if you tell someone like that, tell one of those people that someone is gay, that's not defamation because it doesn't cause their reputation to suffer at all. So defamation depends on the circumstances. And it's something that would hurt your reputation in a segment of the community. And of course, that depends on the community you're in. What if I call someone a Democrat? He's a Democrat. Well, I don't think that's defamatory. Nothing wrong with being a Democrat. Some people might think it's defamatory. If you go into an MBA program and accuse an MBA of being a Democrat, that might be defamatory among her fellow master's students in business administration. I know being a Democrat is not very acceptable in that crowd. There is a case that found it defamatory to call someone a communist. A communist. Well, I can see that certainly in the state of views in America from time to time in past decades, calling someone a communist could be a great harm to reputation. People were blacklisted during the 1950s for someone calling them a communist. That's a significant harm to reputation. There's another kind of odd case. Someone called a woman a cocotte, which is a French word. And the court translated this, and it's the court kind of said, very deadpan, that cocotte either meant prostitute or poached egg. And I don't know if it would be defamatory to call someone a poached egg, but it was defamatory to call someone a prostitute, and the court inferred that was what was meant here. And even innuendo can be defamatory if I say someone is intimate. Well, intimate's a nice, vague word, right? Intimate could mean anything from friendly to promiscuous. And it's, again, you have to look at the circumstances and the likely meaning that the audience will take from this. So all of these are the sort of things that can cause injury to one's reputation. And it doesn't have to be a characterization. You could simply describe some false facts without even characterizing them, and thus someone would be considered defamed. There are all these stories about Shannon Doherty. I don't know if they're true or not. You know, she tried to kill her boyfriend or her husband. I don't know if that's true or not. Repeating those stories, though, and it's not true, that would be defamation. Now, another requirement of a defamatory communication is that there be a reference to a specific person who does the suing. You can't sue for defamation unless the defamation refers to you. Well, in many cases, this seems very easy and plain. If I say, you know, Joe Smith is a cocotte, obviously I'm referring to Joe Smith. Lots of times, though, it's not so clear. There's a famous case involving Neiman Marcus, where someone wrote that the models at Neiman Marcus were call girls. And the models took umbrage, understandably so, and sued. But they lost. The reason they lost was that Neiman Marcus employed over 380 models, and thus the court said this general statement that the models at Neiman Marcus are call girls, you know, applied to such a large group, it would not necessarily be modified to be applied to one individual model. But that same article said that certain male employees at Neiman Marcus were fairies, meaning gay, and they won because there were, I believe, less than 20 male employees. So if you characterize a group of 380 people, it's not associated with one specific person. But if you characterize a small group of under 20 or 25 people, That comment may be associated with each individual person, and thus it could be defamation. When I was in law school, my moot court problem... See what you think the answer to this is. Someone published an article saying that three starting quarterbacks in the National Football League were gay. And one quarterback sued and said this defamed him. And I still don't know the answer. They don't. These practice cases, they don't tell you the answer. The argument was that, there aren't that many starting quarterbacks in the National Football League, and so it would be, it might be associated with a given one. Of course, they didn't say that three were. They didn't say they all were, so why would it be associated with one specific person? And, he argued, well, maybe I'm prettier than the other ones or something, so they'll think it's me. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one. But, think about it yourself. There's got to be a reference to a person, though, for it to be a defamatory communication. And another requirement of defamatory communication is that it be believed. That it be believed. Obviously, if a defamatory communication is made and no one hears it or no one believes it, there's no harm to your reputation. What if a tree defames someone in a forest and no one is around? Well, there's no defamation because no one heard it. Likewise, if the comment is said by, someone who's a known liar or someone who has no credibility with this audience, so it's not believed, there's no defamation because your reputation was not hurt. Somebody who's not believable stands up and lies about you, your reputation was not hurt. Likewise, if someone insults you to your face, suppose there are two people and only two people around, one defames the other one, says something defamatory to his face, is that defamation? No! It's defamation to tell a third person about you. It's not defamation to tell you about you. You should have a little self-esteem here. You shouldn't let other people, hurt your reputation of yourself by lying about you. You don't have to worry about that. So it's got to be believed. No defamation from insulting a person just face-to-face. There was sort of another interesting case where two Greek people got in an argument in a restaurant surrounded with people who aren't Greek. And one of the Greek people said something very, very rude to the other Greek person, but he said it in the Greek language. While there were many other people around, none of them understood Greek and had any idea what they were talking about. The only one who understood Greek was the person being told, and can't defame a person to themselves, so it was not defamation. Okay, in addition to a defamatory communication, to recover for defamation, the statement must be false. It's not defamation if it's true. If a guy is a crook, you can call him a crook, and it's not defamatory. If a woman is unchaste, whatever that means today, you can call her unchaste, and it's not defamatory. It's got to be false. Now, originally, in the good old days of defamation, the plaintiff would bring a suit claiming that this false statement was made. And then the defendant, the one who did the speaking, would have to bear the burden of proving the truth of the statement. This has changed. In fact, much defamation law has changed because defamation law obviously impinges upon the First Amendment. The First Amendment guarantees us freedom of speech. It doesn't guarantee us freedom to lie, necessarily. But we want to protect speech, and we don't want the courts of the government coming in and penalizing people for speaking things they reasonably believe to be true. So now, for this and other reasons, proof of falsity is increasingly a burden of the plaintiff. Proof of falsity is a burden of the plaintiff. The plaintiff has to show, before you can bring a suit, that the statement was false. Then the defendant can attempt to rebut that at trial and prove it's true, but it's not a burden on the defendant. Falsity, what other falsity issues are there? Well, one falsity issue is courts generally will not give you defamation for technical falsity if the statement is substantially true. Not defamation for technical falsity if the statement is substantially true. Thus, suppose I were to write an article in the newspaper saying that I found out that Bruce Willis was on an interstate highway driving 145 miles per hour. And that hurts his reputation because it's very unsafe to do that, right? So Bruce Willis sues me and says this is false. I wasn't driving 145, I was driving 146. 144. Well, okay, my statement is technically false, but it's substantially true. So we're not going to find that to be defamation. The defamatory content of the false part is trivial, meaningless. So that's not a false statement. There's no defamation. Now, another requirement of defamatory communication is that it must is called publication. Publication. Publication here does not mean publication in the sense of written in the Atlantic Monthly magazine or something like that. Publication means simply told to a third person. Much as I told you it had to be believed, before it's believed, it has to be told. Publication is any communication, pretty much any communication that's made, so long as it's written or oral or could, I suppose, be in semaphore, neither written nor oral, and that would still be okay. And it even extends to negligent communications, I guess, times when you didn't really mean to be telling a third person, but you were, the third person was there. And in this context, it's also worthwhile to know that you're liable for repeating a defamation. You're liable for repeating a defamation. So you didn't say it first. Someone else said it and you repeat it. This is obviously a circumstance such as a newspaper or a magazine who quotes someone in their pages. And the person they're quoting is defamation. The newspaper would like to argue, well, yes, the person we quoted had a defamatory comment, but we didn't. We didn't vouchsafe for it. We simply repeated it. Why should we be liable? Well, because you are. Because you're spreading that defamation. You're taking that defamatory statement, which may have been made to a small group of people, and expanding it to a much broader audience. And you know what? It's true even if the repeater says he doesn't believe the story. This is a way to get around the newspapers and tabloids and things, printing all sorts of sordid little things and then gossip and rumor and getting away saying, well, we don't really believe it. But if I print a story about, some politician and I quote some enemy of the politician who says that, this politician has done all sorts of terrible things, and I say, this is what the Republicans say, but no one really believes a word of this. That's not good enough. That doesn't get me out. If I repeat it, I'm potentially liable for defamation. Now, am I protected in any way? Yes. If I tell a story and then I say, I don't believe it, I think it's false, that makes it less likely that the audience will believe it. If the audience doesn't believe it, you don't have to worry about defamation liability. But of course there will be people out there in the audience who will read the story, says, yes, that has the ring of truth to me. I've always thought that about that congressperson. Then the publisher says something like, well, don't believe this. This is all bogus. But the guy in the audience says, no, I don't think so. I think I agree with the first statement. And then it becomes defamation. Reprinting, republishing defamatory comments is defamation in its own sense. There is some protection. Libraries became worried. I think you think about it. You see how libraries could become worried. What if you go into a library and check a book out of the library and that book contains defamatory comments? Well, the person being defamed could, of course, sue the person who made the defamatory comments in the book and the book publisher. But they might also sue the library because, after all, the library made it available. Do you think so? No. There's no liability in defamation for distribution of defamatory content. Thus, you cannot sue Federal Express for the fact that they transmitted a magazine containing defamatory contents. It's only the actual printing, publication, or saying on TV certainly is defamation. But repeating defamation is itself defamation. Now, there's another doctrine here, which is kind of new and unusual and interesting, and that is called the doctrine of compelled self-publication. That is called the doctrine of compelled self-publication. What if you say something bad about yourself? Can you sue for defamation? Well, that seems a little silly. Who would you sue? Would you sue yourself? And what would be the point be of suing yourself for defamation? Maybe there would be some tax reason. I don't know. But that's not what we're talking about here. What if you repeat someone a third person said to another third person? Is that defamation? Well, once again, that seems a little fishy. Nobody made you repeat it. Why should you get the first person liable? But here's how the doctrine of self-publication can arise and can be tricky. You were employed. Your employer fired you and called you a crook. You're an innocent man. You're not a crook. But you're fired, nonetheless. You go to a new employer. The new employer says you look like a good, qualified person to hire. Why were you fired from your last job? Because you are completely honest. You say, I was fired from my last job because my employer said I was a crook. The new employer says, ooh, well, then we don't want you. Should you be able to sue your previous employer for defamation? Traditionally, the answer was no. Traditionally, the thought was that, well, you don't have to be that honest when you're giving, you know, the reason for you being fired by the in the past case. But the doctrine arose out of an interesting case. There are always some unusual facts that create different situations and produce new doctrines. Here's what we had was we had a blind person who was working for an employer and who was fired. And the blind person asked for a job recommendation, a reference for the new job. And the employer gave the blind person a job recommendation. And this job recommendation said some, you know, mean and nasty and untrue things about the blind person. So the blind person, you know, took the recommendation and may not have even known its contents. Then went to apply for a new job. And the employer said, do you have any job references or recommendations? And the blind person said, oh, why, yes, here. And the new employer would read it and would say, ah, well, I don't think we're interested in you. And after this happened a few times, the blind person began to wonder what's going on here and had someone read the recommendation and discovered that it was full of defamatory comments. And the blind person sued the former employer. And the former employer said, we cannot be liable. We did not tell anyone. We did not ourselves tell anyone. The employee, the blind person, you told them when you gave this job recommendation out. The court said, no, you can't, that's too technical. You can't get off on that, employer. You gave this recommendation knowing that it would unavoidably have to be turned over to a third party, and that's enough publication for us. That qualifies as publication. Well, it started off just being in this one case, in these special circumstances where the employee was blind. But now it's been extended to the cases where people have to defame themselves unavoidably. That is, if you create a situation where this person, where the employee, will be put in a situation either of lying or repeating defamation, you may be liable if that person is an honest person and repeats the defamation. Now, the employee, of course, can say, well, of course, it was wrong, it was a lie, I didn't steal, blah, blah, and maybe that will be believed, but maybe it won't be believed. And if the new employer reasonably believes that the, you know, this person's a thief based on the false and irresponsible recommendation of the old employer, that's defamation. This is called the doctrine of compelled self-publication. Now, there are some specific defenses to defamation. These are often called privileges. The first we'll talk about, there are some absolute privileges. Absolute privileges to defame. That's a pretty good deal, isn't it? You can say anything you want about anyone without any regard for truth, and you can get away with it. You can't be sued. Well, who has these absolute privileges? How do I get one? Well, the absolute privileges are pretty narrow. The absolute privileges are things like judges. Judges have an absolute privilege. You go into a court, you lose a case, the judge says you are a thief, so what do? Why not sue the judge, doggone it? The judge wrote this opinion saying I'm a thief, let's sue the judge. No, you can't. Judges have an absolute privilege. Also, members of Congress are another group that has an absolute privilege. They can stand up on the floor of Congress, say pretty much anything they want, and get away with it because they have an absolute privilege. We want, you know, Congress people to talk in an uninhibited fashion. However, there are some interesting cases that have limited that. Some members of Congress have said this absolute privilege also should apply to their communications made away from the floor of Congress. If they say something in a restaurant, or if they write an op-ed piece for a newspaper, does the absolute privilege extend there? No, courts have said it does not. The absolute privilege only extends to official proceedings. Well, these are nice absolute privileges, but these are not very common, don't apply in most cases. There are some other privileges which are not absolute, but which are qualified privileges. Qualified privileges, which enable you to maybe do a little bit of defaming, not too much. Well, the best known qualified privilege is the public figure privilege. The public figure privilege, which was rather immortalized in a movie, Absence of Malice, Paul Newman, you know, you may have seen it. That is to say that in an ordinary defamation case, all the plaintiff need do is prove the statement was false and the plaintiff can recover. But there's a different rule where the plaintiff, the person defamed, is a public figure. If the person is a public figure, you have to show something that's often called malice. It need not just be false, but it need be maliciously false, although malice isn't defined the way you think it is. So you can get around saying things false about public figures if it's not too terribly false. Well, what does that mean? First, who's a public figure? Who would be a public figure? Well, obviously, public officials, politicians, are public figures. We certainly want to be able to say bad things about them. That's what America's all about. But not just politicians. Famous entertainers are public figures. Famous athletes are public figures. Famous is basically it, public figures. Now, it is said you are a public figure if you have thrust yourself into the public eye. And I suppose anybody, to be a successful entertainer, pretty much has to thrust themselves into the public eye to accept this public figure status. It also could apply to other people who have thrust themselves into the public eye in a different sort of way. I'm not sure if Tanya Harding, the skater, was a public figure simply because she was an Olympic skater. Perhaps she was. She certainly became one given the events surrounding the attack on Nancy Kerrigan. Likewise, Lorena Bobbitt, just a simple Virginia, I think, housewife, certainly wasn't a public figure. But you take off a knife and start hacking off your husband's public parts, private parts, maybe some public ones too, I'm not sure. At any rate, that you do something like that, you're going to be a public figure. And David Letterman can say things about you, and you have limited defamation protection. So a public figure is someone who's thrust themselves into the public eye. And also, I would note that you can be a public figure for a limited audience. You can be a public figure for a limited audience. Consider America's greatest physicists. Well, name five of them off the top of your head. I'm impressed if you can. You might be able to come up with, Stephen Hawking, maybe Steve Weinberg. I don't know if you're educated. Many people couldn't name any. Most people couldn't name 5 or 10. So how could such a physicist be a public figure? And such a physicist may not be a public figure for purposes of an all-purpose article in the National Enquirer or someplace like that. But what if you write some terrible thing about some famous physicist in a journal of physics? In that context, the person is probably a public figure. All the people who subscribe to and read this journal of physics know this famous physicist. I think people who subscribe to those journals do. So that person could be a public figure for purposes of that limited audience. Okay? Now, suppose someone is a public figure. Can you defame them at will, freely? Not completely, no, not entirely. There is this doctrine that says even a public figure can recover for defamation if the false comments were made out of malice. Now, malice to you doubtless means something like mean-spirited, with an evil mind, something like that. In the law here, malice means a little bit more. In the law, the malice in the qualified public figure privilege doctrine means recklessness also. If you recklessly say a false thing about a public figure, you may be liable. Now, notice the key value of this qualified privilege is that you can say something wrong, false, and it's not defamation. If you had reason to believe it's true, but if you say it recklessly, you don't. Well, there are all these great tabloids here, and even more in England. You know, the National whatever, and they have a track record of saying all sorts of wild things about people. And they are able to do some of that because of this public figure thing. Most of the people the tabloids talk about are public figures. You know, Roseanne Arnold or someone like that, certainly a public figure. But they have to be careful because many of the things they say might well be reckless. You know, they hear a rumor and they reprint it without checking the facts. That could be reckless, and that could be defamation of even a public figure. There are some people who have written for these magazines who have frankly testified oh, we just make these things up that seem likely. Well, that may not be malicious, but that's reckless. And so even a public figure could recover there. And in fact, there was a well-known case where Carol Burnett recovered a substantial judgment from the National Enquirer. The National Enquirer had a very strong and impressive battery of lawyers to defend itself against these cases. But Carol Burnett, there was one that was so recklessly false that Carol Burnett won a judgment against them. And I think this explains, in part, why many of these tabloids have shifted over somewhat from exposés of famous entertainers, Bert and Lonnie, whatever, to tales of aliens, you know, landing and or alleged birth giving to someone with six heads or something like that. Well, these things that are totally made up, you know, an alien's not going to sue you for defamation. Something like that's totally made up, there's no defamation risk. It's a little bit easier for them. Bigfoot's a popular one. If there is a Bigfoot out there, he might go sue you for defamation. But so far it hasn't happened, and I think they're probably safe. Okay, that's the qualified privilege to defame a public figure. It's not really a privilege to defame, but it's a privilege to be wrong if you have some reasonable basis for believing you're right. There's another important qualified privilege, and that's the sometimes called the qualified business interest or public interest privilege. This privilege exists to permit the free flow of important information within a context such as a business. Here we're talking about recommendations, job recommendations. You are asked to give a reference or a recommendation for a former employee. Now, many times people have given these recommendations or references for former employees, and they've tried to be honest, and then they were sued by the employee for defamation, which has caused businesses to do things like refuse, I'm not going to give any references, I'm not going to make any recommendations. I think that's an overreaction. There is a qualified business interest privilege that says that if you're making a reference to another business, you've got a good, reasonable business interest, you have a qualified privilege to defame falsely if you had a good faith belief in the truth, okay? You can give a recommendation. You're not going to be liable if it's a little bit wrong, so long as you had a good reason to believe it was true. And this also extends to other cases. There's a general public interest in issuing a warning. So if someone dangerous, if you know, the Dalton gang is coming to town and you shout out, the Dalton gang is coming to town, they're known killers. Then, of course, the Dalton gang sues you for defamation. Killer is a defamatory comment, even to a Dalton gang member, I suppose. You might have a public interest privilege there. Well, this doesn't mean that a business person can say anything wild and unsupported they feel like with respect to their former employees. There are limits to this qualified privilege, which is why businesses get a little scared. The first limit is the comments you make must be in good faith. What does that mean? You must believe they're true. You can't go around openly lying about your former employees if you don't believe it's true. And you should also make a reasonable investigation of the truth for your protection. In other words, if you have a hunch that this person is a thief, you just have a hunch this person is a thief, and you fire him, that's probably okay. You probably can fire one of your employees on just a hunch that he's a thief. But if you then repeat the fact that you thought she was a thief, you really didn't have any sound evidence, it was just a hunch, that could be defamation. That's not enough of a good faith belief. If you investigated, if you found some evidence this person was a thief, then you're okay saying it. But if it's just a hunch, you can't say it and still take advantage of the qualified business interest privilege. You've got to have a good faith belief, which I think is just a good rule. You shouldn't go around saying bad things about people if you don't know they're true. Now, a second restriction on the qualified business interest privilege is that there cannot be excessive publication. There cannot be excessive publication. You can publish this only to the extent necessitated by your business purpose. Only the extent necessitated by your business purpose. What this means is that if another company comes to you and says, we want a recommendation, you can do that. But don't put a big ad in the local newspaper. That's not necessitated by a business purpose. If you say, I would like everyone to know that I fired so-and-so because, you know, they're a crook, a malingerer, a pervert, you know, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't get you the business privilege because the general public has no need to know that. Likewise, the communication must only be limited to subject matters of interest to the business privilege. So if this person, if someone comes to you and asks for a recommendation, and you say, sure, I'll give you a recommendation, they're talking about a recommendation limited to this person's business activities and business responsibilities. And if your recommendation goes on to delve into all sorts of private details in this person's life, totally unrelated to their business performance in the job, then you may also lose the qualified business privilege. So if you're careful and responsible, the business privilege is a valuable one. You limit your comments to those that are truly necessary. Suppose you're wrong. Suppose one of the things you honestly believe after reasonable investigation proves to be false. You're still not liable for defamation because of this privilege. But if you go around saying things recklessly, or if you spread them far beyond the need, then you may be liable for defamation, even in a business recommendation context. Okay, let's talk about some cases. Let's look at a few defamation cases. Melvin Belli, very famous trial lawyer, known sometimes as the King of Torts, was giving a speech to the Bar Association of Florida. An article about this said he took, that was the word, he took the Florida Bar by charging some expensive clothing to his hotel bill. You know, somehow he was able to charge these suits to his hotel. This was in an article. And he sued for defamation. Now, there's an important lesson here, which is that if you're going to defame someone, don't defame the lawyer who is known as the King of Torts, right? Now, I thought this was sort of interesting, that if one of the defenses here was sort of interesting. The defense by the people who published this said, this isn't saying he took the Florida Bar isn't even a defamatory communication. It just, we're just speaking to his cleverness. Shows how clever he could be. Well, the court didn't buy it. The court said that such a statement that he took the bar suggested dishonesty. And dishonesty is, of course, a defamatory communication. So, Melvin Belli, one big surprise. Okay, here's one. A fellow, I'll have name here, Tony Shreve, to help keep these people straight. Tony Shreve worked at an electric power plant, big utility plant. And he thought he found some serious plant safety violations. So he lodged a complaint about these plant safety violations at the electric plant. He had a supervisor named Lewis Stultz. He made these complaints to his supervisor, Lewis Stultz. Well, Lewis Stultz was one of these supervisor employer types who does not like a whistleblower, who does not like a troublemaker. Rather than trying to correct the safety violations, or rather than trying to pass on the safety violations to upper-level management, Stultz made up a story that Shreve had threatened him with physical violence. He said, you know that Shreve guy? He threatened to beat me up, when all he had done is report these safety violations. So this was reported to management. Management discussed this matter among themselves and others and fired Shreve. They fired Shreve based on this report of a threat, totally fabricated report of a threat of physical violence. Then Shreve sued the electric company. Now he sued for defamation because in the course of firing him, the electric company had discussed the matter with various people and thus had defamed him, you know, by repeating this threat of physical violence to various people in the company. So who should win here? The court says the electric company wins. The electric company wins under the qualified business privilege. I mean, it seems terribly sad and unfortunate, but the electric company was relying on the word of the supervisor. It was found that this was pretty much the case of the word of the supervisor, Stultz, against the word of the employee, Shreve, and that the employer had some reasonable basis, even if it was false, to rely upon the word of the supervisor, Stultz. So by saying that, they were able to take advantage of the qualified business privilege doctrine, and they were not liable, which is very sad for Mr. Shreve, except he still has a remedy, of course. He can sue Mr. Stultz. Now, Mr. Stultz, you know, may not have the resources of the electric company, although because of some agency law principles, you may be able to reach those resources anyway, depending on some other facts. He still has a remedy. But the specific comments made by the management who fired Shreve were not defamatory. They were protected because they had a reasonable basis. Here's another case. A worker at a company had gotten into several accidents while driving. He was a worker. Part of his job was to drive a vehicle around, and he'd gotten into several accidents. He was told by the employer that you're unsafe and you're going to be fired. Well, but the employer did not just tell him that he was unsafe and going to be fired. The employer got a little overly officious. The court wrote a letter to the union and wrote a letter to other construction companies in the area saying this worker is the worst driver in the city, and anyone hiring him is asking for liability. So the worker sues them. Does that sound like defamation? That sounds a lot like defamation. But what would the company's defense be? Well, the company has a defense that this is true. I mean, the guy's gotten into several accidents, and if the court can prove that he's likely to get into a lot more, that he's the worst driver of the city, or substantially the worst driver in the city, then it's a true statement, and it's not defamation. Though an employer might also like to argue that its statement was only an opinion and not a fact. But its state was. But here we're getting a little too specific for opinion. The worst driver in the city, that's an opinion, but it's getting a little specific. I don't know if that would work. Okay, how about, here's one I want to get in. It's a new point. What about a retraction? Suppose the newspaper defames you, says something false about you, and then they publish a retraction, saying, we were wrong. Is that good enough? Should you still be able to sue for defamation? Well, for some plaintiffs, it is good enough. For some plaintiffs, that's all that they really wanted. But for others, they won't be satisfied with that, because it's a well-known fact to people who study the media that bad news, that sort of thing, sort of bad news is believed and retractions are never heard, especially because the critical stuff tends to be on page 1 and the retraction tends to be on page 38, right? So is a retraction good enough? Not necessarily. And some retractions are particularly insufficient. This is an old case, but a goodie. A newspaper published a statement saying that a certain person did not have the manners of a hog. Didn't have the manners of a hog. This was a local where people knew him. So he threatened to sue them with defamation. And the newspaper's retraction, as printed, was that we're sorry, we were incorrect. He does have the manners of a hog. This person does have the manners of a hog. Well, that sort of retraction is not going to be very effective. As a matter of law, a retraction is mainly effective in mitigating damages. That is, a retraction of the statement has its main benefit in that the damages may be less because some people, you know, may not believe the original story after the retraction. Though, as we've talked about before, a retraction doesn't always, you know, change everybody's mind. Okay, one more quick case. There was a newspaper that published a report of a city council meeting. A developer was trying to get a variance on certain piece of land, a variance to build a certain type of building on a certain piece of land. The developer suggested that unless the city gave him the variance, he would not sell to the city a piece of land that the city wanted. And the city wanted this piece of land. He said, I'll sell you this piece of land if you give me the variance. The newspaper article on this said that the developer was engaged in blackmail. So the developer sued for defamation. Developers are another group. It's hard to defame, but you can do it. The developer sued for defamation. Blackmail, of course, is a terrible crime. So that seems defamatory, right? Well, the newspaper won. It was not defamatory because the court said someone reading the article would not believe that the developer was being accused of the actual crime of blackmail. It was just, you know, a loose use of the word to say he was using this bargaining leverage, and they described all the facts, and the facts were basically true, so that was good enough. So the developer lost that case. Okay, time's up on defamation. Thanks a lot.